Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. And today we welcome a guest on our show. He's a private investor and has been the CEO of two listed companies. And his name is Paul Johnson. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And you?
Yeah, not bad at all. Not bad at all.
Good. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, Mark. Hi, Paul. Good to have you on. End of another investing week. The investing weeks seem to get quicker and quicker. I don't know if it's because I'm getting older and older, but the 5 days are just flying in. I don't know if it's one of those days where I'm looking forward to Monday or looking forward to the weekend. I've not quite decided yet. It's a kind of strange week.
What do you guys think of the old saying, you know, sell in May and stay away, and was it don't come back till St. Ledger's Day? Does that still hold true then? I mean, the summer months always tend to seem to be a lot more quieter, don't they?
I think it was Jesse Livermore, the famous US investor, that used to go away, I think, during the summer months and would close down his positions and right. Have a couple of months, 2 or 3 months, I think, off by the seaside somewhere, following that principle that you've just said. I remember back in 2010 when I was thinking about this principle and it was about, I don't know, May, June time, and I was thinking, you know what, I'd had a good run, really good run. For about 18 months, I thought, you know, should I shut down my positions and just literally go away? And I didn't, because I just felt addicted to, as I do today, to the market. And I thought, no, I'm gonna stay with it. And I had my biggest winners in July, August, September I'd ever had, that really propelled me to group, you know, really, really big levels. And in that period, of wins enabled me to pay off my mortgage. I mean, it wasn't an entirely happy ending, because I had to hand over the keys, as it were, because my share of the house went to my first wife in the divorce settlement. But it was nice to pay it off.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah. At the end of the day, the companies don't stop working July, August, and September. So, you know, news can come out any time. It's just the liquidity's gone in the summer sometimes. So that's what drags it down a bit. But
I think so. You've got to be careful with this assumption of quiet periods. There's a few things over the years. Recently with COVID-19, and you know, a lot of companies seem to have just shut down. And we've never been busier, because we've been doing a lot of corporate-related work. And so we just bashed through all this stuff, because we've not been traveling. We haven't had to go in for meetings in London or anything like that. So just been able to crack on with things. You can get some good stuff done. But you hear lots about Christmas holidays, when companies often say, oh, don't put news out over Christmas and New Year, because it's kind of a dead season. But I think investors are switched on in those periods, because they don't get much news flow coming out. They see something, it's kind of not fighting with lots of other news announcements. It gets the attention quickly, so it's worth pushing news out in that kind of period. And summer again, you know, who's going to guess what's going to happen this summer? I mean, would you end up predicting what was going to happen in our world in, say, I don't know, 1st of February? I don't think so. And where are you going to predict what's going to happen this summer? I don't know if it's going to be a dead summer. I don't know if it's going to be a horrendous summer with markets collapsing and all this. And I don't know if it's going to be a cracker where, you know, gold stocks just fly through the roof. The problem in our space is that if you get out of this game at the wrong time, so you think, right, markets are going to collapse, I'm going to sell all my junior gold positions, for example, because I'm into that. That's my, you know, interest area, small resource stocks. I'm going to sell all my positions and I'm going to get myself out, go to cash. I'm going to sit there comfortably. I'm going to, if I can, go on holiday. And then I'm going to come back in September. I'm going to fire up. What happens if our sector moves en masse 2 to 3 times? Because that kind of thing can happen in times like this. And if that's the case, that gold stock that you sold for 1p, are you going to really want to buy it back at 3?
Yeah.
You know? And then you'll feel a bit sickened at the concept. And then maybe after the summer, when it's at 3, you go, It'll probably come back because it was at 1 2 months ago. And then suddenly it goes up to 5. And then you're thinking, oh, this is way overpriced. So I'm not going to buy this. It's going to collapse. And then it's at 7 8 9. And eventually when it gets to 10, 12, 15, you begin to go, oh, no. You feel sick because you've missed out that opportunity. And all you had to do was sit and hold, you know. And if Greatland Gold bring that old chestnut back in as taught as anything, it shows that a stock can move way beyond levels that people predict in advance. Yeah. And with very good reason. And that can happen to any stock that has a good business and makes a decent discovery. And it can happen to quite a few dogs as well, in fairness. Mm. Perhaps not to the level of Greatland, but, you know, you can see 5, 10, 15 times in almost anything in current market conditions.
Well, I thought maybe that was the example you were referring to, and it was Greatland Gold, because, yeah, I mean, what a story there. You know, that really is testament to what can happen. A turnaround story. And I believe that you were did you have some involvement in that in the early days?
Yeah, well, I've followed Greatland Gold for a long time, 2007 I think it was onwards, and then eventually with Metal Tiger I did the refinancing restructuring back in April 16 that brought in the investment of Metal Tiger there was a bit of a board change around, happened over a few months. And I was on the board for, 3 or 4 months. And then Javier on came in and, the story. Well, first of all, it was Newmont engaging over Ernst Giles with a kind of exclusivity arrangement. That was back in 2017, I think. Then there was excitement over the Pilbara because they had the Panorama projects in the Pilbara. And then Newmont didn't proceed with Ernst Giles in the end, and the price pulled back, and then Javier on started exploration, and then there was the big discovery. So, you know, incredible story. And the irony of this story is that back in April 16, when we announced that we were putting £150,000 of Metal Tiger's money in to Greatland at 0.01 pence, I got quite a bit of abuse for that from a number of investors and market commentators at the time. Amazing things can happen.
Indeed.
I've actually seen there's a guy on Twitter, I can't remember his name, but he's put out his own research note in Greatland Gold, and his target is 86 pence a share for Greatland Gold, which is about £3 billion, which is just off the scale. I mean, obviously that's just his personal research, but it's when you think point one of a penny, 86 pence. Yeah, that would be the ride of a lifetime, so it would. But okay, Paul, moving away from stocks just for a wee while. Usually we get our guests on and we like to dig deep into their history, what they've done before they came to market, and you know what you were like as a younger chap, etc. Wonder if you could take us back and just give a bit of your life history. Yeah, you can go back as far as you want, but let's keep it maybe to 15 minutes, Paul, because I know you can talk. So
how about I keep it to 2, because I'm not entirely sure what to talk about in the past. But I was born in Manchester, in just East Manchester, and for those up there in the north, between in a place called Gorton. And I was born into a quite a strict evangelical Christian family. So I spent most of my early years going to church 5 times a week, 3 times on a Sunday, once on a Wednesday, once on a Friday. I didn't have an awful lot of general life, in fairness, but my dad was a lay preacher, and he was a good one as well. So he used to go around effectively and preach in different churches and the gospel evangelical message. And it's a long story, but when I was 18, I used to think about what did I want to do. And I think around the time I was 18, the film Wall Street came out, and I thought that looks fantastic, you know, all those kind of big screens and big offices and that kind of stuff, and trading stocks and shares. And I think that's what I'd like to do. And the irony is, it took me a while, but I eventually got there, and I now sit at my desk with multiple screens with lots of things twinkling. And I think I'm not quite made it. I've got a way to go, but Well, that was, I was perhaps right when I was 18. Well, I went to university in Manchester, got a degree in management sciences, and the claim to fame of the university was that the old boss of Tesco's went there, Terry Leahy, if you remember him,
okay,
to the same management school as me. And the I basically learned all these different things about psychology, sociology, economics, law, and it's just across everything degree. And then I had a bit of a tour around, kind of a year off-ish after university, and then didn't know what to do. So I went for a few interviews and chartered accountants practices, and they seemed to be kind of like a relatively straightforward and easy thing to do, you know, to become a chartered accountant, which was an error of judgment. So, but I joined a firm called Neville Russell, which is now Mazars. And I joined them in Dudley, in the Black Country. So I trained as an accountant for 3 years in Dudley, and passed the qualification, and went to Ernst & Young in Birmingham. Didn't like it that much because it's very corporate and very big, and I don't like to do as I'm told on the whole. So changed to a different career. Went into loss adjusting, so I started to do big commercial insurance claims. You know, like big food factories burning down and data centers blowing up and river floods flooding out businesses and calculating how much losses they made and so on. And then he eventually went to work for an American insurance company to help them with risk management on major risks. So trying to calculate how much their exposure would be if one of their factories, one of their clients' insurance covered factories blew up, and spent 3 years flying between the UK and the USA all the time, literally. I remember on one occasion I flew back from the USA landed on the Saturday morning because it was the 5th of November, and went to the bonfire party on the Saturday night. So I'd flown from Boston back to the UK on the Saturday morning, and then on the Monday morning, 2 days later, I flew back to Boston. But I was... I wanted to spend some time with the kids on bonfire night, so flew across the pond twice in the space of 2 days. It's crazy. But I decided after a period of time that I really did not like being told what to do and working for someone else. So eventually I migrated into my own business, and at the same time migrated into more active stocks and shares. And this was around 2008-ish kind of time. And I was looking around for what I should invest in, and AIM and small caps are something that had intrigued me for quite some time. I've been trading on and off in the gaps when I wasn't focused on doing work, and so I kind of migrated into it full time. It worked like a dream for a period, and I made a decent amount of money. But then in the I got a bit of a kicking 2007-2008, I think one of the stocks I was invested in back in 2007 was maybe Regency or Red Rock or something, and the price collapsed on me in the summer. And when we were away in France, and I got a big kicking in summer 2007. And then, of course, in summer 2008, the financial collapse happened. So come the end of 2008, with virtually bugger all left in the portfolio, I was kind of wondering if it was the right decision to actually work for myself, because I was doing a consultancy business at the time, and 2008 stopped consultancy contracts. People didn't want to bring in any discretionary spend stopped, and of course the markets collapsed, and it was a bit of a bad quarter four in 2008, to be honest, before all the fun started. So that's the background. I'm a background Christian boy, evangelical Christian boy, and perhaps have moved away from that a little bit over the years. But
perhaps
yeah, from Manchester, and that's it.
All right, okay, well, so you're talking about investing there, Paul, so what's your, well, you don't need to say you stick to these rules, but what are your top five sort of golden rules for investing then that you like to try and stick to, but as you know, sometimes emotion gets in the way and you end up not sticking to these golden rules?
You know, it's funny, and I don't want to be controversial, but why not? I tell you what I've learned, and I was chatting today to someone about this. I was on the phone. We were talking about a business proposition, and I asked the question for this new business proposition. I won't say who it is because that's completely wrong, but that it clear that they haven't invested a lot of money into this, cash into this. A lot of these small resource companies start out where they are, they kind of give their time for free, as it were, and then they get shares in the proposition. They don't put cash into it, but then they go and get investors' money, and then they push the business forward. And I kind of understand that model. I get it. It's called sweat equity when they get free equity in exchange for services. Sometimes it goes a bit too far, you know, the freebie equity route. What I like to see is money going in, people putting cash in. I think when you put cash into something, it really, really marks you out as being focused, because it's all right giving your time for free, but physical cash, your cash opening your bank account in, is completely different. So I asked the question, you know, when do you intend to put cash into this business? And I got negative response, basically. There's clearly not going to be cash going into the business. And it made me think about this acutely, because I don't want to be unfair to people, but in all I do, I always try and plough the money in at the same time. Because if I'm asking investors to put like money into one of my companies, I think I should do it as well. So I tell you what, the number one thing is make sure that the management teams that are working on the companies have skin in the game.
Yeah, definitely.
100%. I don't care what else they do. And there are very rare exceptions. They do happen when there isn't skin in the game and they haven't put cash in and things still work out. But make sure they've got skin in the game, make sure, if you can, because it's largely, the biggest success factor.
I suppose that's a big flag as well. You know, if they've got skin in the game, you can probably say, well, it's not really a lifestyle company, because these guys are pumping in, you know, whatever it is, they're putting in 50 grand, 60 grand or whatever. It's a good flag to see.
Yeah, spot on. And ask them if it's cash going in.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
That's the other ruse. I think depending on which market you're on, depends on the level of disclosure required, but ask them if it's cash going in, because that's what you want to see. You want to see physical money going in. You don't want to see that they've accrued, you know, 100 grand worth of executive costs that haven't been paid and they just swap it for shares in the business. Mm. Ask them if it's physical cash they've paid into the company, and you'll see a few wins, I tell you.
Well, how would you ask the director then? Would you actually ring them up and ask them?
Yeah, just, I think, to be honest, this is another thing. I used to think it was important to get in touch with directors, to go and see them face to face, to kind of stare them in the eyes. And I think in some cases it is, and it can be useful for investors. The problem is, I think there's a tendency, once you start to get to know people, you're engaged with them too much, you become too comfortable. It becomes like a friendly relationship with the management team of a company that you're invested in. You don't really want that, because just because you're friendly with them, it doesn't mean you're any more protected or you're any more knowledgeable. You can take yourself to a corner where you think you're protected, you think you've got more information than everyone else, and you don't. So I think you have to keep a degree of control on that. But yeah, you can ask I would always, if I'm speaking to directors, say, how much money have you put into the business? And they'll say, oh yeah, I've invested $180,000. Okay, fair enough. Then how much of that was cash? And what they'd say, what do you mean? I said, well, how much of it was physical cash that you sent into the business that wasn't crossed over in respect of any consultancy fees and that kind of thing? And just ask the questions. Ask them about the other thing is options. Director options is another way you can incentivize the board. And if they've got good options and they're good challenging prices, it can help. It kind of sets... it tells you the mentality of the directors. If your share price is half a pence and the warrants come out and they're half a pence, you go, oh, come on. You know, it's like your warrant price is at the market. Oh, sorry, your option price is at the market. Now, an option is where, of course, you can buy that share for a fixed price, 0.5 pence, say, for a fixed period, say 3 years. So I would be looking for an option price If the market price was half a pence, I'd be looking for a price of twice that, because I want to feel that there's a target to go for. I also don't like options that are too long, option periods. So if the directors have options in their own company and they're 7 years, I'm thinking, come on, 7 years. Surely 3 years is enough. If they can't hit a sensible performance after, within 3 years, then really they don't deserve the options. Now, so I would say option contracts that the board have are quite important. Watch for when they put them into EMI schemes, Enterprise Management Initiative schemes, because that's the tax protective scheme for executive directors who work more than, I think, 20 odd hours a week in the business. If they put them into EMI schemes to protect against capital income tax and capital gains on when they use them, that's a massive sign. A lot of people don't, and that's because they're not necessarily thinking that they're going to make a lot of money off them. So if they put them into EMI schemes, definitely they're thinking that I'm going to crystallize these options at some point. I need to protect myself tax-wise. And, you know, just to flag Power, that's what we've done at Power. We've put our executive options into tax-protective wrappers because I believe we're going to use them and it's going to save us a fortune. A lot of people don't realize that when directors who are on PAYE, like normal tax, in the UK, if they have unprotected options, they have to pay. When, let's say the option price is 1p, exercise price, and the market price is 11p, if they exercise those options, they have to pay income tax on the 10 pence gain per share at their highest marginal tax rate. So you know, you've got, if you're a director of a company, you think you're going to make a big windfall off your options, you need to protect them in a wrapper. So two things we really like. The first one is cash in, and the second one is the option structure. The third thing is, how much did they pay themselves? Look at that. Because honestly, if you pay yourself a fortune, you simply don't, you're not aligned with your shareholders. Because you can make more money off your salary and your perks and your benefits and your big expense accounts than you can off any share gains,
your
own business. You know, so you got to watch out for that again.
What's a fair salary then, Paul, in your opinion?
It's the kind of thing that it's difficult to quote and difficult for people to understand. If you look at the salaries in the UK market, you'll find a lot of CEOs will be on somewhere in the region of around £150,000 to £200,000. It's quite a common level of payment for CEOs. Boards are commonly on hundreds of thousands of pounds. You know, as a group, like £300,000 to £400,000 is quite common in the UK market. It's nuts. You know, if you're running these small companies that have, shall we say, a limit in terms of financing capabilities, then, and you're paying your board hundreds of thousands of pounds, there just isn't the money there for to go into the operational development that you need. So that's never been kind of my philosophy in terms of junior companies. I've always gone down the low range of the salary kind of options. And I also look for that in terms of the companies. Now, if you have a massive success story and you become a massively bigger business, then what's the problem with paying yourself the money? Because you can finance yourself easily at lower levels of dilution to your shareholders. Yeah, but it's difficult to peg an exact figure on it. I can tell you this, that based upon my work in terms of the company I'm in at the moment, my entire board in this business is on effectively, a common salary of a single CEO in other companies, in other junior companies.
Right.
Okay. You know, but that's where it needs to be.
That's the whole board, Paul.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, mate. So that's five.
So it's five directors. It's three non-exec directors, one executive chairman and one executive CEO. And the thing is that, you know, if we get, as I anticipate, hope, whatever, a big discovery and our market valuation drives dramatically higher, will I increase the salary levels in the business? Yeah, once we've got more money in, potentially. But I like to think about the bonus side of things in, you know, in the sense that if you sell something for a considerable amount of money, you know, can you have a bonus structure in place that rewards excellent performance crystallizing to real money? That's one way of doing it. You know, a sensible thing. Share performance options. That's another way of doing it, so that if your share price goes up, then the board benefit dramatically. But I just think this big salary stuff is a no-no for these small companies.
Yeah, I agree there. So it's very much for you about the board and the management team, and I guess it's what you've been saying. And of course, you're currently, you know, the CEO of Power Metal Resources, and of course, you were the CEO of Metal Tiger. So how did you get into those companies and those positions, and what have you learned from them?
Well, it's funny because what happened with the first position was back in 2012, the shareholders of ECR Minerals voted off, I think, two of the directors, and the board was left with two only, and they needed more directors. I was then doing some work where I founded with a partner, Mining Maven, the investor communication site, and we basically through that we were working with ECR Minerals at the time. I always used to like going to their office because they had a big bowl of fruit and like treats and stuff every time you turned up, which was great. But they needed a director, so I went on as a non-exec director. And I remember the time exactly because it was almost to the day when my son Henry was born. So he's just over 8 years ago. From that ECR, we had to do a bit of jiggery pokery to keep that company going and to make it. And it ultimately turned it from a big net debt situation to a big net cash situation, which was a fantastic, interesting time. And I think a few people made a lot of money off that move. But then I was introduced to Cameron Parry, and then we started Metal Tiger back in 2014, I think. Metal Tiger. And then it kind of just goes on from that, really, because Metal Tiger was ambitious. It invested in lots of different companies.
Yeah.
And it kind of helped a lot of companies get through some difficult years around the 2014 to 17 period. Junior companies in the markets, including Greatland Gold, including Thor Mining. You know, there's lots of different companies that we put money into in the junior resource space. And that, I suppose, that my doing the Mining Maven work and meeting lots of companies in from 2010 onwards, and then working with ECR, then Metal Tiger, and having success in both of those for shareholders, then and doing lots of investments opens you up to different things, and I ended up going into lots of companies. What I tried to do is not. I've only done three before Power. I've done three roles that were really threw myself into heavily, as it were. ECR, Metal Tiger, and then Thor Mining. In the other companies, what I've tried to do is go in there, refinance, restructure, get everything set up, make sure it's all clean, because you do find some skeletons in the closet when you do these restructurings and refinancings that you need to deal with. Once it's all clean and it's all running, move on and leave it to it. Now, I've been accused, because I kind of understand it, of jumping and hopping around. But my ethos was always that, you know, you just got, you only do your job as long as you need to. And if you're into restructuring businesses, then there's only a period of time you need to be there to make sure it's working, and then you can move on. But it also, it's also quite a tiring thing to do, hopping around all the time. So I'm now onto my fourth kind of long-term role with Power. I've been doing it for 16 months, but including the setup, because it was a couple of months running before it actually came out, as it were. Then it's been about a year and a half, and it's great fun.
Yeah, we've spoken before on Stockbox, and you always make quite clear that, you know, you're sticking around in Power, and you're very happy that you've sort of built the business and you're ready to push on with it. So is that still the plan? Do you feel very like it's your baby now, and you're sort of sticking around and through, you know, longer term?
It's not my baby because it's a public company, so it's owned by the shareholders. So yeah. I'm only able to stay for as long as the shareholders want me to, or provided I can do the proper job. And you know, at the moment, that seems to be the case, to be honest. But it might not be forever so. But what I want to do is what I felt with ECR. The share price went from 0.08 at the lows up to 0.72 in 2013. Then Metal Tiger from 0.5 on the initial financing all the way up to just under 6.5 in a couple of years' time, from 2014 to 16. And Thor Mining from 0.475, I think it was, all the way up to 4.375 in the space of 18 months or something like that. Those kind of moves are absolutely fabulous. And I'd like to see that happen for the shareholders in power. And that's my main driving force, to be honest. When the volumes kick in and when everything gets exciting, that's what I want to. And I see shareholders make a whole heap of money, then that's just fantastic. So, yeah, that's my aim.
Yeah, I suppose that the flip side of driving the share price up, Paul, when you're driving the company, is that you probably can't sell at the peak because you're locked in. I mean, that must be frustrating. You know, watching your share price go up 5, 6, 7 times, and you know as a director that you're locked in, and there's a very small window of opportunity for you guys to sell.
Yeah, I would tell you what's more frustrating, Kenny, is actually driving the price up, getting the company in a great position, and then leaving and watching it all collapse back down, and in certain cases, on certain occasions, because of things not being done in the way that perhaps they ought to have been done. And some cases, it's just the way the market works with the cyclical nature of it. No, I've got to be clever in terms of if I'm staying with this business, then look, if you drive the share price up of the company dramatically and then you want to take a little bit off the table, then I don't think anyone can sensibly criticize you for that. But we're in a strange market where people don't like it if you sell. So you've got to be careful and manage that process really carefully. Otherwise, and the far easier route is to find ways to crystallize value that actually helps shareholders to receive some kind of dividend distribution or some other benefit. You have to be a little bit careful doing that, of course, because you've got to make sure there's the right tax treatment. If you do something in a manner which hurts shareholders because they have to pay income tax on any kind of distribution, then that can result in a lot of the value that you generate for them being taken away by the tax man. So you got to use innovation and think about things carefully. At the moment, my focus is not so much about me and my kind of how do I get out of this thing. I'm locked into power, and I'm mentally and physically. And I'm locked into keeping my shareholding. The first thing I'm thinking about is we've built the business model, we've got things in place, we've got the news flow, we've got some phenomenal interest. Let's get the share price up considerably so that people can actually make a bit of a return. I know it's been difficult markets, but we've been flopping around interesting and low share price levels almost since we started. It started to pick up and show a bit of life. So I just want to get this thing moving properly.
So, what's your what's a typical day for Paul Johnson then? You obviously had experience in the previous companies. What have you learned, and how do you apply that to power?
Yeah, well, I start with yoga at 4:30 in the morning.
And I don't believe that.
No, I do, because I do it on Skype, and Kenny's there as well. No. I do yoga in Scotland, and with a can of Tennent, and then we kind of go for a jog. Only do about 8 miles a day. You know what the funny thing is? It's we're in at the moment. It's a bit crappy because I'm on major long days. We are so kind of busy work-wise. So it's like predominantly how, and I suppose I'm up. I can't stay in bed longer than about 6 a.m. normally. Unless I take one of those pills, in which case it could be a little bit longer. And then I'm pretty much on the go all the way through the day until I'm such a bore. I feel sorry for Michelle, my wife, but I'm pretty much on the go until like about 9 o'clock at night every day, and then I try at the weekends to kind of kick in and do stuff, and actually contribute a little bit more at home. So my life as running public company is you do a lot of intensive work around regulatory things. So final results, as we had for some time with power, that takes up a lot of time. You've got to do an awful lot of liaison with auditors, accounts, preparers, Nomad, all sorts of different things. You know, people are, I think as investors, and I as an investor before became a public company director, didn't realize how much time goes on to those things. So we released our final results recently, and then we've got, you know, interims coming up, because as everyone, you know, knows on the market, that you have to release your interims in 3 months of your half year end. Our half year end was the end of March, and therefore by definition we have to release by 30th of June. And so that takes time, and to do all that kind of stuff. Otherwise we have a lot of contracts flying around at the minute, as you would expect, again, because we've got joint venture agreements, we've got earning agreements, we've got all sorts of different things that require proper detailed review. I like to look at everything myself. I don't necessarily understand all things, but so I spend a lot of time reading very lengthy, boring documents, making sure we're doing the right thing. I don't travel much. I used to travel a little bit. The last time I traveled overseas was to for a brief trip to Canada for PDAC in at the end of February, and then before that was a trip for a few days to Arizona, it's a whole hodgepodge of different things. Of course, the thing I love to do is the RNS writing.
Yeah,
that for me is my fun zone every day of the week.
Okay.
Yeah, I think in an ideal world, Paul, if you could get away with it, you would have a 7 a.m. RNS every day, wouldn't you? You would like that.
No, yes. I mean, I don't know. Is 7 a.m. the right time?
It depends what kind of news it is, Paul, I suppose.
I tell you what the problem is. Under the rules, you are supposed to release as soon as you practically can, you know, if you've got something that's price sensitive. So, and we literally do that. We put it out any time that it comes out. Would I do one a day? I was accused a few years ago in Metal Tiger of being the Tiger Woods of RNSs or something, where I released 14 RNS in, or 70 RNS over I don't know how many months. Look, I think it's important. You put your money into the business. And you don't get an RNS update for weeks. You kind of, it's not fair. You need to know what's going on. You need to know what's happening. Okay, and it's my fault. I release more RNS than most other people will release. And I tell you why. Because we've got more business activities going on. We've got different projects in different jurisdictions. We're not yet on a sensible market cap, like we're at £3 million, which means that when you're potentially, you've got a 7 kilometer copper anomaly in the DRC, you've got big nickel sulfide drill targets in Botswana and in Tanzania, you've got a significant project in Cameroon near Kamuna, big cobalt nickel deposit, you've got the big Australian portfolio. Any one of those things can be material enough that I have to disclose to the market, because our market cap is small. Now, if my market cap's 30 million quid, then some of the smaller things that I, you know, today that I would have to talk about through public RNS wouldn't necessarily be that, sensitive anymore. But whilst we're at low levels, they are. And, you know, Katoro, our holding in Katoro, which we publicised this week, 10 million shares, 10 million warrants, that stock goes up, as I believe it will, then that becomes a very material event for our company. But it's only one small part of our business. And so, yeah, we're a bit trapped. And this is the problem we have with Metal Tiger, because when with Metal Tiger, we invested into Kibo Mining and we made £1 million at the end of 2014. So we had the ability to do a lot more things very quickly. And that came with a problem because as an investing company, price sensitivity was determined by how much something was compared to our previously published assets. Now, our previously published assets in our historic financial statements were quite low. So almost anything that we did where we made a profit, you had to disclose it. And people were saying, why have they announced that? That's just frick. Well, no, it was announced because it had to be announced. And it took us a while before we caught up. So our published results were at higher asset levels. So we didn't have to announce so much. And it's, it's just one of those things. But I like to, I mean, you guys tell me, if would you prefer to have a regular feed of news about what's going on, or would you just prefer to sit and speculate for a month?
Well, yeah, regular news for me, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's times when you want maybe a bit of radio silence. You know, you maybe don't want to be putting out news if you're working on a big project or a big, you know, financing or fundraising. You know, whatever it is, there's obviously going to be a period of time when you don't put news out, and sometimes that works to your advantage. So it does. I mean, people speculate what's going on. We've not heard anything for 2 weeks. Oh, you know, yeah. So there's a time to be quiet as well. It has its uses, shall we say.
You're absolutely right, actually. In fairness, there is. I mean, it's something I struggle with because I can't over communicate. But where we are, I think, as a business at the moment, is we're going into some pretty intense periods and some pretty busy periods. So. And I think that's been articulated through the, through the RNS. Some of these projects, assignments, and possibilities we've got are going to shut me up because physically, there just isn't going to be the time to get the job done in the background and continue to release kind of regular updates. So there is going to be a bit of forced radio silence, and I won't feel comfortable about it in the slightest. I can tell you.
Yeah, there's definitely been an increased level of PR in the last, I'd probably say, the last 4 weeks from Pow. You guys have seemed to have stepped it up. Well, you in particular, obviously, Paul, you're the face of Pow Metals, so it's you flying the flag. Do you like it that way? If one of your directors come up to you and said, actually, do you want me to do some PR, would you let them do it, or would you just put them back in the box?
So sometimes it works. I think if they've got something to add, I think the smaller companies are usually led by one person, in the sense that that's the person that the business is focused around, and that's the face that people get used to. And yeah, some people like you, or some people don't. And I like to keep the consistency. I've tried in the past with Metal Tiger. We tried to do different people doing interviews or presentations. It didn't really work, to be honest, in the way that we thought. And with other companies, much the same thing. I think each company needs a strong lead, needs a focused, consistent lead, and that's part of your job, really.
Yeah. Some companies it does work. I mean, Greatland. A bit of a double act. You usually get Gervais and Callum doing a bit of PR as well. They work quite well together, so that's exceptions to the rule.
But I think that when you get a big success story, it kind of opens up to bringing in other people and to doing these things, you know, alongside each other. I would say in the build up to the big success story of Greatland, the focus was on one person mainly, Prince Public, and that was Gervais. I think it's it's just part of the overall role. This is the problem that you get in the public companies. You often get very good geologists who are not great business people. Mm-hmm. It's the same in my business. You get, you know, accountants, generally speaking, don't run big accountancy practices. They have a commercial manager. Same as lawyers, they'll have a chief executive running the business, not a lawyer. You know, it's because different people have different skill sets. So you'll see that there's a lot of very good people commercially there, good business managers there, but they're not good with PR and investor relations. And that's a big problem. So, you know, good, well-run business, but it doesn't promote itself, or technically very good projects, but the geologist involved isn't great at standing up in front of an audience and articulating what they've got in simple terms. And my biggest advantage, I think, is that I really, half the time, don't know, you know, much about anything. And that means that, like, internal meetings I have or in discussions I have on new projects and so on, I ask the really stupid questions. I mean, I do ask some cracking stupid questions. And I just think if looking at it from an investor's perspective all the time is what I do. And I'm thinking, okay, what would I want to know if I was putting money into this? And if I don't understand a term, and you know, geologists and lawyers and all the rest, they don't half like throwing out terms. You know, I work with people that love throwing out complicated terms every day of the week. And I just say, no, I want to ask another one of those stupid questions. What does this mean? And so on. And what happens there? And it's important to do that.
Definitely, 100%. So any stocks in particular, Paul, at the moment that are catching your eye in the market? I mean, just we don't need, you know, spend 15 minutes on it. Just
you've got to think about 15 minutes. Any stocks catching my eye? Right. For obvious reasons, I think Katoro Gold's looking really, really strong now. He's got his decent financing away.
Yeah.
And I'm not a lover of discounted financings. And there was some criticism about him doing it below the market. If you look at the chart on the stock, actually, these placings, by the way, don't happen that fast. In fact, sometimes they're a bit slow. And if you look at the chart on the market, he'd come up from about 1.6, I think, over a few days or a week or so, or whatever. So the perceived discount was greater than I think it actually was in reality. But his share price has now started to get stronger. It's up a bit today. He's got money in his business to enable him to push forward with a degree of comfort. The Blyvoor Gold and the, you know, the Hennetti nickel project or polymetallic project. He can actually breathe a little bit and he can focus on doing the operational activities. And I think it's going to do well. I think it could do very, very, very well. I can't talk entirely about the Hennetti side of things, of course, because of with Power having a up to 35% interest in it, there's a bit of crossover there. But I think it's a great stock. I look around and I see some amazing things that are incredibly low values. Thor Mining. I mean, I got, I don't know, 60 million shares. I can't remember the exact number in Thor Mining. I've held it for a long period of time. It's my biggest paper loss from its highs when it was worth a heck of a lot of money back in 2018, early 18. It's come back a lot. It's a business with one of the biggest strategic assets I've seen in America for tungsten and Pilot Mountain, 100% owned. Perfect asset at the perfect time. It's got gold in Australia. It's got copper in Australia. It's tungsten in Australia. They're doing this uranium thing in the US, whatever. The original assets of the business are the thing that drew me in. And they've got a vanadium project that's
trillions.
And trillions, literally, if you do the math, you've got to do it for us. Yeah, Kenny, you've got to pull out what is the value of the vanadium potentially in situ in their project. Bonya, isn't it, I think? Is it Bonya?
Gervois.
Gervois, yeah. Honestly, And this thing has got 100 billion shares in issue. It's valued at 3 or 4 million quid, and it's absolutely bizarre. It's bizarre. And yeah, there's lots of criticism going into management and direction and strategy and all the rest. And some of that's justified, and in fairness, some of it's not. And it's one of those companies, I just think, he's just going to wake up one day to an announcement, hopefully on Monday, and the share price goes on a bender through the roof. And it's a bit like a rock fire where it fell to 0.25, gets a good hole out with that gold at his plateau project. And then suddenly he's trading at like 2.5p.
Yeah.
So I think Thor has the potential to do that, which is why I still hold it. Comroy, I absolutely love Comroy. I mean, in fairness, I do like the Comroys. Maureen and the Professor Comroy. I'm not entirely a fan of how they've gone about running the business and how they kind of do things, as they know. But I have to say, they've got up to 15 to 20 million ounces of gold in a conceptual short compliant a conceptual target across that 60-kilometre project in Ireland. We've got 570,000 ounces in place already under JORC compliant resource.
Yeah.
And you say to yourself, okay, at the moment they've got 26 million shares in issue. I'll have to calculate it. And they've got a share price of 10.5p. So their market cap's about 2.7-ish million quid. If this were in Canada, you'd be lucky if it was 27 million quid. It'd probably be a lot higher.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely bizarre. That's why they keep going to PDAC. It's not because it's a major party. It's too plumbing cold for it to be a major party. It's because that's where the money is and that's where the partners will come from. And if they don't get a major partner in on that project in the relatively near future, it will be a shocker, in my view. It's a major project every day of the week.
The professor's too old to party now, so he is, Paul. You're talking about PDAC and he's going to party. He's too old. I can't remember what age. He must be in his 80s now.
He is, yeah. But in fairness, when you meet him and have a chat with him, he's sprightly and full of energy. I don't know if that's because he's got a good salary but he's it probably could be a contributing factor. He is a gent. He's very engaging. You could get very into liking him an awful lot. I do kind of like him an awful lot, to be honest. And they're always very kind. And when I see them and talk to them and so on. But I don't really care about whether they're kind to me. I'm just that you've got a major strategic asset. You've got a project which is phenomenal, and you need to get a big partner in, because what needs to happen now is they've tested this 60-kilometer system up and down. They've got some really good evidence of mineralization across this 60-kilometer trend. Now, if this thing kind of joins up in the way that they think, and that this is a project that is worth an absolute fortune, and but you need to get someone big behind you to go in there and whack in the drill holes and do the work.
Yeah,
if you're talking about the Comroy project in Ireland has similar mineralization to Fosterville. You've got to start putting in some deeper holes, and you've got to start looking for this thing. And it costs some money, and you need a big firm behind you. They get a big firm farming on this, and with a tight capital such as that. I mean, I've got, I can't remember how many shares, to be honest, but a lot, a couple of million shares. And this thing is flying high, big time, and I just wait for that. I mean, that's okay. I'm going to change from thought. I want CJNR on Monday to be my announcement where it says we've got a big farming partner, because that will fly.
No, I know I do that. You'd already said it was to be a Thor, but you've actually given me an idea, Paul. We should perhaps get you on in the future, and we can just talk about some stocks, because that's a whole separate podcast in its own. So it is. I'm looking at the clock, and we've probably been on for an hour, and my laptop's actually down to 15%. So
That's not the real reason. It's Friday night. You want to go and have a beer. Yeah, let's talk about a few stocks. The problem is when you recommend stocks, well, or talk about them, then you just got to be careful because I always feel responsible for everyone else and the money going in. But this is magic land. Amazing things can happen. You can lose an awful lot of money. 2018-19, from my perspective, oh, my God. Tough times in terms of getting through and continuing to do the job, keep yourself sane and working hard. But when you get the right end of the market, you can make a lot of money as well. Let's hope that in the coming months, gold continues to fly, shoot through $2,000 and more, and then we all get happy clappy and make a fortune off the junior resource space.
Definitely. But just before my laptop dies then, Paul, we usually ask our guests to do a 60-second pitch for their own company. You up for that, to give us a 60 seconds and why? Yeah. How is a screaming buy?
Okay, before your laptop dies, we're one of the few companies at £3 million cap that's got two major projects, Tanzania and Botswana, with significant large-scale drill-ready targets. We pop the drill holes in the ground. We could make a major discovery. That's why we're doing it. We've got a 7-kilometer copper anomaly in the DRC that we're investigating. No one really bothers exploration stage, but if we confirm that anomaly and that copper mineralization and potentially cobalt, that's a very valuable asset that someone will come in and work with us on. And alongside that, we have got in Australia one of the biggest land packages, right slap bang in the heart of the Victorian goldfields, with the joint venture where we've got a 50% interest. We've got a variety of other things sprinkled around the portfolio, any of which could deliver a dramatic return well in excess of our market cap. Now, it may not work. We may not achieve this. I've never failed in the past, to be honest, in terms of this type of scenario. And this is the strongest portfolio I've ever had. So have a look, take a look at this, do a lot of research, get yourself comfortable with what we've done. Don't invest in us until you've really looked through our materials on our website and our presentation. But most importantly of all, if you have any questions, concerns, worries that would stop you from making an investment in Power Metal Resources, pick up the phone, send me a text, write to info@powermetalresources.com, and I will come back to you and try to answer your questions and try to remove your doubts in your mind.
Perfect.
Great.
Yeah, that was just over a minute, but no, perfect. Mark, you anything to add before, like I say, my laptop gives up the ghost?
No, except to say thank you very much, Paul, for your time today. Very informative. And the details that you put up there for shareholders to contact you, is that the same information if they want to join the Paul Johnson yoga sessions?
Yeah, you're welcome. That's not a problem. So we should maybe RNS reach the pictures on Monday.
Yeah, okay. I look forward to that. Great. Perfect.
In reality, Mark, he just gets up and has a fag. Is that right, Paul?
Not strictly. No, I like to put Good Morning Britain on first of all, and then go for a fag.
Right, cool, perfect.
Right, okay.
Appreciate your time anyway, Paul. Cheers.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.